You know, there's an old saying, kind of trite, says, you only live once. Well, certain perspective, that's not true. But suppose you could live your life over and over and over again, you know, infinite number of times. What kind of prospects would that bring for you? What would that tell you? Would it give your life meaning? Well, I want to explore a book that touches on that subject and touches even the wider issue of what is the meaning and purpose of our life to begin with. Come on in.
The fact is, I have very logical reasons for believing in things that logic and reason cannot teach me. It's kind of ironic, but the more complexity science finds in life, the more unlikely becomes the whole scenario and theory they use to explain the origins of life. The amazing thing that quantum physics shows is that nature, at its most fundamental level, strains human credulity and belief in ways that biblical faith never does.
Hi, Cliff Goldstein here. Welcome to the program. In his novel, The Unbearable Lightness of Being, Czech author Milan Kundera deals with the subject of, well, the unbearable lightness of being. Well, what does that mean? Well, first of all, look at the inner tension, the inner paradox of the title itself. We have the unbearable, meaning hard to bear, hard to carry, of what? Of lightness, of something that doesn't weigh much. So right off the bat then, there's this strange paradox. And what is that something, that lightness, which is so unbearable? Well, according to this book, it's being human. It's our existence itself. It's what Martin Heidegger meant by his famous German word, Dasein. It's from what the Greeks called ontos, being, from which we get the fancy philosophical term ontology, which is basically the study of being, of existence. What does it mean to be? What does it mean to exist? What is the difference between being and non-being? What is the ontological difference between 20 imaginary dollars that I have in my pocket and 20 real dollars that I have in my pocket? And also, you know, why is it believed that something which exists is more perfect than the same something which does not exist? You know, I mean, I'm sure these are the kind of questions that keep you up all night pondering them and so on. But what then does Milan Kundera mean when he writes a book called The Unbearable Lightness of Being, The Unbearable Lightness of Existence? Let me read you a few quotes from the book, because I think they catch the point of what Kundera wants to say, and I think they're points that are well worth our considering. He opens the book by talking about Nietzsche's myth of internal return. It's this idea of what would it mean if we have to live our lives, the exact lives that we already live, over and over again, and then on and on forever. Think about that, living your life over and over, again and again, and unceasingly. Let me read you. Putting it negatively, the myth of returnal turn states that a life which disappears once and for all, which does not return, is like a shadow without weight, dead in advance, whether it was horrible, beautiful, sublime, its horror, its sublimity, its beauty, mean nothing. We need to take no more note of it than a war between two African kingdoms in the 14th century, a war that altered nothing in the destiny of the world, even if 100,000 blacks perished in excruciating torment. Wow, that's pretty heavy if you think about it. A life that lived once and then disappears means, he says, well, nothing. Kind of sounds a little bit like the stuff I talk about on here. Here's Kundera again. Here's another quote from Kundera again on the same thought. If the French Revolution were to reoccur eternally, French historians would be less proud of Robespierre. But because they deal with something that will not return, the bloody years of the revolution have turned into mere words, theories, and discussions. They have become lighter than feathers, frightening no one. There is an infinite difference between a Robespierre who occurs only once in history and a Robespierre who is eternally chopping off French heads. Heavy thoughts. Heavy thoughts. Again, worth pondering. The French Revolution is lost to history. It won't happen again. So it becomes, at least to us, at least to people who can think about it, nothing but mere words and theories. But if it were to happen again, and again, and again, then it would be, to use Kundera's own word, frightening. I mean, it would be bad enough to get your head chopped off by Robespierre once, but having it chopped off by Robespierre an infinite number of times, well, that would be, would it not, infinitely worse. Let me read Kundera another quote. Let me read another quote for him. He says, "We live everything as it comes without warning, like an actor going on cold. And what can life be worth if its first rehearsal for life is life itself? That's why life is always a sketch." No, sketch is not quite the right word, because a sketch is an outline of something, the groundwork for a picture, whereas the sketch that our life is a sketch for nothing, an outline with no picture. He then continues with the German phrase, Einmal ist keinmal. Forgive my German accent. Einmal ist keinmal, says Thomas to himself. What happens but once, says the German's adage, might as well not have happened at all. If we have only one life to live, we might as well not have lived it at all. Whew, that's heavy. Einmal ist keinmal. That's what I have called this show. It means literally in the German, I remember I asked a German friend of mine, means literally in the German, one time is no time. It's idiomatic, an expression for the idea of that Kundera is saying, which is that if something happens just once, only once, it doesn't count. Thus, if Maxi Robespierre chops your head off only once, it doesn't count. Life, because it's lived only once and then is gone, doesn't count either. That is what Kundera is saying. Einmal ist keinmal has kind of a poetic ring to it. Let me read a little more from Kundera. Einmal ist keinmal. What happens but once might as well not have happened at all. The history of the Czechs will not be repeated, nor will the history of Europe. The history of the Czechs and of Europe is a pair of sketches from the pen of mankind's fatal inexperience. History is as light as individual human life, unbearably light, light as a feather, as dust swirling into the air, as whatever will no longer exist tomorrow. Whew. Again, it's kind of heavy, kind of depressing, but you know, it's so poignant and powerfully true. Einmal ist keinmal. In other words, it's meaningless, it's pointless, it has no purpose. Though at the same time, though, I'm not sure that having this life repeated over and over again would give it meaning, at least as it is now. I mean, if getting your head chopped off by Robespierre once makes life meaningless enough, I'm not sure what having it being chopped off by him an infinite number of times would make it mean. Because if that's what eternal return is all about, having to do this over again and again and again, where I would think maybe we're better off doing it only once, as meaningless as it might all seem. Meaningless that is temporary, I suppose, is better than meaningless that is eternal. What do I mean by that? Read the ancient Greek myth of Sisyphus, and you'll know, I think, what I mean. You know, it makes me think of a few lines from a character from Dostoevsky's novel, The Possessed. It's a book about a group of Russian revolutionaries in the 19th century who have all sorts of grandiose ideas about a new Russia, a new man, and the like. One of the characters is doing, interestingly enough, he's doing a paper on why, not a study on why people commit suicide, but he's writing a paper on why people don't commit suicide. I like it, it's a little macabre way, I kind of like it. Kind of a strange twist, don't you think? I mean, psychology and so forth study why people kill themselves. This guy Kirillov said that quote, "But I only seek the causes of why men dare not kill themselves." That's all. He says, let me read you some more from Kirillov, from Dostoevsky. He says, life is pain, life is terror, and man is unhappiness. And then he goes off about all this silliness about the new man. I think it was the theme that later helped underpin Soviet ideology, which Dostoevsky saw coming, and which could explain why his book later fell out of favor with the Soviets, because Dostoevsky was very negative about this. Anyway, he talks about this new man in, you know, Kirillov, and then he says the following, he who will conquer pain and terror himself will become a god. In fact, he later makes the statement even stupider and more sillier. He who dares to kill himself is God. I mean, come on. I mean, I don't know. Where do people come up with this stuff? Because I guess Dostoevsky was mocking it. But he who dares to kill himself is God. Anyway, before I digress too far, the point, Kundera's point, comes back to what I think in many ways, and as I've stated here numerous times, is the dilemma of our evanescence, of our temporality, and what it does to the meaning of our lives. This is so much the theme of Kundera's book. It's interesting to have this guy, he's saying it. It's a desire for meaning and for transcendence in a life that might not go beyond what this life has in the here and now. And since the here can be so quickly gone and the now can be so quickly done and gone, it can all seem so painfully futile. If, though, it didn't happen only once, could be eternal, then perhaps there could be some meaning to it. That was, in fact, a theme of a fascinating short story by Adolfo Cesaris. He was a young Argentinian who, in 1940, published a novella, The Invention of Morel. Now, The Invention of Morel, it's a diary of some unnamed fugitive condemned to life in prison for what the book never says. Following the advice of an Italian rug seller in Calcutta, he flees to a remote island where some people have built a chapel, a museum, and a swimming pool before abandoning the island. He, the fugitive, is going to have the whole island to himself, or so he thought. So he goes to this island, and suddenly people start appearing out of nowhere, it seems, and he had to flee and hide in some kind of low-lying swamp. So he secretly watches them, and when possible, he eavesdrops on them. And then he soon noticed that, with the regularity of the tides, these people would appear for about a week and then disappear for a while before reappearing and doing the same things that they had done the last time they appeared. In other words, they came and went, and they did the same things each time they came, and then they disappeared. Did they exist, he wondered, only in my brain, tortured by the privations I have suffered? Now, among these intruders was this young woman, Faustine, and the fugitive falls in love. unable to stand it any longer, he decided to come out of hiding, come out of his swamp, and declare his love. But how? He writes, "We are suspicious of a stranger who tells us his life story. He'll tell us spontaneously that he has been captured, sentenced to life imprisonment, and that we are his reason for living. We are afraid that he is merely tricking us into buying a fountain pen or a bottle with a miniature sailing vessel inside." He finally does. He finally goes up to her, but she ignores him as if he weren't there. No matter what he says, no matter what he does, she and the others don't even acknowledge his existence. How can this be? What in the world is going on here? He's either, he concludes, hallucinating from a disease, or the bad air of the swamp has made him invisible, or they are from another planet and are unable to interact with humans, or he was in an insane asylum. Or he thought he was like Dante visiting the realm of the dead. What was going on? Well, eventually, the fugitive discovers the truth. One of the intruders was a man named Morel, had invented a machine that took, quote, photographs of people. But these photographs captured everything about them, their action, words, thought, feelings, smells, and on and on. When all the senses are synchronized, says Morel, the soul emerges. So the idea is when fully captured, the person died, but his or her image lives on forever, at least as long as the machine, powered by the tides, keeps projecting them. And what happened was Morel recorded certain aspects of these people with his special camera, then choreographed them in a week of life, which played again and again and again. Only the, quote, people don't remember anything about the previous projection. In other words, they live the same scene over and over, each time as if it were the first. Morel says, "We will be able to have a life that is always new." You know, Morel said, okay? So, you know, and so Morel, who with Faustine reproduced himself through this invention so he could be with her in paradise. In other words, he fakes this machine, makes this machine where these people can live over and over again, even though they're not really people and they're not really living. Anyway, the fugitive, despite knowing that Faustine's an illusion, he still loves her and decides to allow the machine to capture him so he can be an illusion too. He says, "I shall have the reward of peaceful eternity." Though a radically different approach from Kundera, the novel touches on the same thing. Only this time, the eternal return isn't the same miserable existence we have here. I mean, Morel didn't have Robespierre chopping people's heads off. Instead, he sought to create the elements from their lives that they liked and just had them go through it again and again and again forever. Either way, through either book, we come back to the same question. The struggle for meaning, the struggle for purpose, the struggle for transcendence. You know, it's funny. I live in the D.C. area. And, you know, this is one of the earlier places where America was settled. And if you go around Maryland and go around Virginia and you go around this area, you can find houses and places that were built in 1785 and so forth. And it's like, wow, look how old that is. I laugh, people laugh, but you know, we see a building around here that was built in the 1700s and it becomes historic. It becomes, you know, something that we want to keep, and it becomes a fame, it becomes a historical treasure, and you're not allowed to tear it down or do anything with it, from something that's a couple hundred years old. Well, recently I was in what they call the Holy Land. Okay, the Middle East. And please, I mean, you have ruins that go back thousands and thousands of years. And it's very sobering. Who knows how many generations of people have come and gone, come and gone, come and gone. Their lives never to be repeated. And all that remain are the rocks. All you see are the rocks there and the outlines of the buildings. Just rocks. It's like the people were drops of dew on a hot pavement. And only the pavement remains. And new drops come on the hot pavement only to vanish and be replaced by new ones. And it goes on and on. I remember my mother once saying, we die to make way for new people, to make room for the new people. You have to be there to see it, to sense that the generations that came and went, and poof, they're gone, as if they never had been there to begin with. All that remains, I said, are the rocks. Let me read you a few names, run a few names by you. Hannibal Hamlin, Richard Johnson, Daniel Tompkins, John C. Breckinridge, Levi Morton, James Sherman, Albin Barkley. Any of those names sound familiar to you? Ever hear of them? They were all vice presidents of the United States, men who were heartbeats away from the presidency of the United States. And today, who's ever heard of them? Einval East Keinmel. If something happens only once, it's as if it never happened at all. That's what I think Kundera, I know that's what Kundera was struggling with in his book. What many writers through the centuries have struggled with, the apparent senselessness of life. What does a life mean that is here only once and then vanishes forever? I remember I read a quote from a scholastic who once said something to the effect of, we know only that we are, but not what we are. We know that we are here. We know that we exist. We know that we, you know, we are, but we really don't know what we are. We don't know why we are here. You know, there are all sorts of views out there purporting to explain us and even to explain our existence. But so often they're so blatantly contradiction to each other, they can't all be right. We know only that we are, but not what we are. Einmal East Keinmel. We find ourselves kind of in a pickle then, don't we? And I think Kundera did a masterful, artful job of explaining the dilemma. But like almost everyone else I've ever read, he comes up with no answer to the dilemma. He's like a doctor diagnosing a disease, but then says we have no cure for it, no way to treat it. I remember a doctor friend of mine telling me that he has told hundreds of patients that they had a fatal disease that was going to kill them. Let me read you another quote from Kundera, because it just shows in so many ways how far he misses the mark. This is the last one. The very beginning of Genesis tells us that God created man in order to give him dominion over the fish and fowls of all creatures. Now, that's not what Genesis teaches, but that's another issue. Of course, Genesis was written by a man, not a horse. There is no certainty that God did grant man dominion over other creatures. What seems more likely, in fact, is that man invented God to sanctify the dominion that he himself had usurped for himself over the cow and the horse. Yes, the right to kill a deer or a cow is the only thing that all of mankind can agree upon, even during the bloodiest of wars. Kundera obviously didn't meet any animal rights fanatics, but that's another story. But then he continues. The reason that we take for granted this right is that we stand at the top of the hierarchy. But let a third party enter the game. A visitor from another planet, for example, who says, you know, someone to whom God says, quote, thou shalt have dominion over the creatures of all other stars. And at once taking Genesis for granted becomes problematical. Perhaps a man hitched to the cart of a Martian or roasted on the spit by inhabitants of the Milky Way will recall the veal cutlet he used to slice on his dinner plate and apologize belatedly to the cow. All very clever, all very cute. But Kindera passed over the only answer to his dilemma, that of God, the God he thinks created, that man created in order to justify his oppression of the animals. Well, as I said, that's cute. But that's all it is cute. It's not too profound and not even close to getting it right. Instead, that God he alluded to in Genesis really has the answer to the dilemma of Ein Mal Ist Kein Mal. And here's the interesting thing, and it goes back to this idea of eternal return, to this things in the world being cyclical. This is a pagan notion of time being cyclical, one that is derived from kind of natural theology, which can, I mean, if you look at it, you look around, you see the cycles in nature and on, and you think everything comes and goes, and it takes a few billion years to run through the cycle, but the cycles, you know, over and over, I mean, the cycles come yearly, and it goes on and on and on. And the idea of eternal return, it all starts over again, and we go through it again and again. And then a few billion years pass, and we do it again and again. That's the idea of the eternal return in Nietzsche. That's to use the example we used earlier. If you got your head chopped off by Robespierre, then sooner or later you're going to get it chopped off again, and on and on and on. That's the cyclical view of time. But the God of the Bible, the God that Kundera thinks humans invented just to justify eating corned beef sandwiches, has taught us something different. Time is not cyclical. It's linear. This world is not going to be repeated, not even once. Instead, it's heading toward a grand climax. And we know that this world as we know it is going to be forever gone. And a new one is going to be created in its place, one that lasts forever. And we are promised the offer of eternal life, a life that lasts forever. Not one like we saw in the invention of Morel, but a life in a world without the things that makes this life so miserable. The prospect of eternal return, at least as Nietzsche expressed it, is a horrible one, and it's patently false. In the Bible, there is a beginning and an end. There is an end. Time moves basically in a linear fashion. Trust me, folks, we aren't going to have to go through this all again. Who would want to? And even if you have it pretty good, you'd have to be pretty selfish to wish this world would be repeated exactly as it has been already. You know, when you think of over the poor billions of poor schnooks who've had a pretty miserable run of it, once I think they'd say is more than enough. Ein Mal Ist Kein Mal. However true, it's better than having to go through this over and over, but it's still a pretty tough pill to follow. Instead, though, it's not the way it's going to be. We've been promised something totally different. And that promise has been found in Jesus and what he offers us. Otherwise, the options aren't so pretty.